Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Will our technology save us, or could it be our undoing? While we are justifiably amazed and delighted by the growing power and convenience of user-friendly machines, they also make it harder and harder for lay people to really understand how and why they work. And of course, none of the advancements we see as necessary to provide us the energy we need to run the world and to protect us from our enemies is entirely safe from misuse or malfunction, which could have catastrophic and permanent consequences. Lloyd Jeff Dumas is professor of political economy and public policy at the University of Texas at Dallas. He explores these realities and the ways we might manage them in his new book, The Technology Trap, where human error and malevolence meet powerful technologies. Jeff, welcome back to Think.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Chris.
So you're quick to point out you don't oppose the development of new technology, but you write that you want this book to be a sort of passport to reality. Can you talk about that?
Right. First of all, I should say, before I came to UTD and started teaching economics, I was an engineering professor at Columbia University, so I have a technological background. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly not opposed to technology. What I think we need to do is make more careful choices. What I mean by a passport to reality is we all know that we're fallible. All of us are. All of us make mistakes every day. But in doing that, we sometimes overlook, when we come to technology, we overlook that fact. And we believe that we can control all the technologies we create. We get seduced by the power and elegance of the technologies we create and forget about leaving a large enough margin of error for normal and inherent and unavoidable fallibility. That's what concerns me. So I think choosing, understanding the realities of why we're fallible, how we're fallible, and what can be done to give us that margin of error we need, that's very important.
Why are we so quick to assume the benevolence of every new technology that comes along?
I think we just get excited, you know, especially in the United States, where Americans are used to technology solving problems and giving us all sorts of amazing capabilities, and it really does. I mean, I'm still amazed when I sit in a plane and I realize I'm in a metal tube being catapulted through the air at hundreds of miles an hour.
While complaining about the food.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And also the communications technologies we have are amazing. You can hit a few buttons on a phone, talk to somebody half the world away, and it sounds like they're in the next room. So it's not surprising we get excited about technologies. The problem is trying to not let that get past us, that we're still who we started out to be. We're still people, and we still make lots of mistakes. I know every day I do something like trying to open my office door with my house key or something of that sort. Most of the mistakes we make are pretty trivial. Mm-hmm. But the fact is the difference between a trivial mistake and a catastrophic error is really situational, not psychological.
So I think we understand intellectually that technology always comes with some trade-offs. But what makes us more likely to focus on the reward than the risk? And as you mentioned, that does get dangerous in certain situations.
I think part of the problem is we make estimates of risk, and we're very bad at doing that, by the way. We're almost always overconfident in our estimates and over-optimistic. And once we've decided that the risk of some disaster is very small, let's say 1 in a million chance, we translate that mentally into it's not going to happen, mm-hmm. so we don't have to worry about it. But in fact, even events that had a 1 in a million chance of occurring, let's say on any given day, would happen about 300 times a day in the United States because we have 300 million people. Mm-hmm. So our ability to understand the importance and to make decisions when it comes to events that are unlikely but catastrophic in potential is compromised, I think, by this kind of mental translation we do. If it's not very likely, that means it's not really going to happen.
But then there's also this question of how we decide. If there's, say, there are 100,000 things that have a 1 in a million chance of happening, you can't realistically address all of them. So there's that question about which ones make the most sense to apply preventative efforts toward.
Yeah, I think you have to look at the potential consequences. Obviously, an accident with a nuclear weapon mm-hmm. is a much more serious matter than an accident with a conventional weapon. So we have to prioritize. And I think we can make these choices pretty intelligently by doing that. But we also have to recognize that the more really dangerous technologies we innovate and put into the world and deploy in the world, the more likely it is that one of them will lead us to a disaster. I mean, we have hundreds, for instance, of offshore drilling platforms around the world, and they're operating and operating pretty well. And then we have the Deepwater Horizon. Mm-hmm. It's a problem that causes a major disaster for the Gulf. So we have to think about where the consequences can be the greatest and apply in those areas our understanding of the need for a bigger margin of error.
I want to talk a little bit about terrorism, because that's something that we do worry about a lot. Why is it so important to understand the correct definition of what terrorism is?
Well, I think, first of all, there are hundreds of definitions floating around, and it makes it very confusing. Mm-hmm. For me, the important thing was to not exclude either the actions of governments or non-political actions. In many definitions, the State Department definition, for instance, is restricted to subnational actors, to groups of some sort, and is restricted to those with political objectives. But there have been groups with religious objectives, groups with crazy objectives who use terrorist means. And to me, any group that uses terrorist means is a terrorist group. And terrorist means implies trying to threaten or attack innocent people in order to create fear and alarm, to put pressure on somebody, could be a corporation, could be the government, to do something you want done. Very crazy people can do terrorist acts and have done them. People who are very rational, who think that this is the way to their goals, can also do terrorist acts. Mm-hmm. Governments can behave like terrorists. I mean, in fact, as far as I can tell, the first use of the word terrorist was to apply to the revolutionary government of France, the Reign of Terror. So, in fact, I think we should not exclude governments. Institutions like, for instance, the Iranian Savak in the days of the Shah and the Nazi Gestapo were state organizations, part of the government, but they were clearly terrorists. They were trying to scare the hell out of people to get them to be quiet and do what they were told to do.
So what matters is the act.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Terrorism is a tactic. And the goals of terrorists, various people who have used that tactic, vary from the totally crazy to, for instance, the leader of Aum Shinrikyo said that his goal was to create ultimate happiness on Earth, and that's why he released nerve gas in the Tokyo subways. Mm-hmm. That logic is a little hard to follow. And there are also groups like the IRA and the PLO in the past who have used terrorist actions, but they have very clear political goals, which you might or might not agree with, but they're not crazy.
Mm-hmm. You present here an absolutely terrifying hypothetical that I hadn't thought about until I read the book, which is that the fourth plane on 9/11, the assumption has been that it was headed for the White House or perhaps the U.S. Capitol.
Yeah.
It might have been headed for Three Mile Island.
Yeah, I think so. I didn't think of that right away, but the New York Times published a kind of a map with a track of where the plane had gone, that last plane. And I noticed the plane came out of the East Coast. It was heading south and west. And then it turned around when it got hijacked, headed back toward the East Coast, did a few jiggles as the passengers and crew fought with the hijackers and crashed. There's something about where it crashed in Pennsylvania that looked familiar to me. So I got out a map of Pennsylvania, took a look, and sort of plotted that path. And about another 15 minutes flying time from where they crashed, and the direction they were flying was the Three Mile Island plant. Hmm. Now, Three Mile Island plant, first of all, would have done a hell of a lot more damage to the United States than an attack on the Capitol. An attack on that plant could have caused an American version of Chernobyl. And that plant is of such a vintage that crashing an airliner into it might probably have disrupted the whole reactor and caused a huge release of radiation. Also, there was this idea that terrorism is a kind of, sounds strange to say it this way, but it's a kind of perverse theater. They do things for the show of it because mm-hmm. that's what scares people and that's what gets attention. And Three Mile Island is a very well-known symbol of American technology all over the world. It's one of the most, I think, one of the two most famous reactors in the world, Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. So it met that category as well. I have no way of knowing whether that's where the terrorists were intending to crash the plane, but it just looked looked like a very horrible possibility that might have been real.
Well, it's a good jumping off point for this conversation anyway, because, of course, it's also a symbol of the way things can go wrong even when there are not malevolent intentions.
That's right. Lots of things can happen because people are bored, because they're isolated, because they're stressed. They can misread things. They can misunderstand things. They can take actions that make situations worse. There's some evidence, for instance, that the operators at Three Mile Island misread what was going on at some of the control panel and actually took actions that made the accident worse than it would have been otherwise. There are also other examples of situations when people were expecting a certain scenario and that caused them to misinterpret what actually was happening and cause a real serious event. For instance, in 1988, the U.S. Navy ship, the cruiser Vincennes, was in the Persian Gulf and had been engaged in firefights on the morning of July 3rd, 1988, with some Iranian gunboats and so on. Then it saw a plane coming out of Iran, rising into the air and heading toward them. Well, they had been warned that the Iranians might try to attack them around the time of the July 4th holiday. This was July 3rd. And so they thought, well, maybe this is it. And they looked at the plane. They saw it diving toward them after it rose into the air, that it was diving toward them. They couldn't find any indication of a commercial flight in the flight guide that they consulted to see if it was an ordinary flight. And they couldn't read the transponder signal. They interpreted it as being an F-14, which we had fighter plane, mm-hmm. which we had sold to Iran in earlier times. So they blew the plane out of the sky, and it turns out it was an airliner, and 300-some-odd people died in that event. Now, if you ask what went wrong, when they looked back at the recordings of what the data were showing them, the recordings were actually showing them that the plane was rising, not diving. The transponder was working, and it was transponding the signal that indicated that it was a commercial airliner. And in fact, in the flight guide they looked, it was listed as a flight, as a normally scheduled flight leaving at a normal time. So what happened? Well, these people were involved in combat. They were very stressed out. They had been warned of an attack. It seemed to be coming. They had this whole mindset that this was it.
Yeah.
And they misinterpreted everything. You could say, well, that's a terrible thing for them to do, and it was, but it's also a normal human thing to do. When you're expecting one thing, you often interpret what you see to fit that model. It's something I call the mindset problem, and it can cause very serious disasters, even worse than this one.
Essentially, it's close enough to what they had been training for to sort of allow them to bypass all the other cautions before they would shoot that plane out of the sky.
Yeah. They saw what they expected to see, and sometimes we do that. That's one of the reasons why eyewitnesses aren't too reliable, because sometimes we see what we think we want to see. Or we think we interpret things in one particular way that may not be the real way things have happened.
Some people would say, well, we'll create some technology that is smarter than the people that might make those mistakes. But this is obviously also a concern for you.
Yeah, you can't do that, really, because people have to create the technology. Mm-hmm. And people build their fallibility, their error proneness, even their malevolence into everything they do in a variety of different ways. For instance, in terms of human error, we have design errors. We manufacture things wrong. We design them wrong. We manufacture them right. We design them right, we manufacture them wrong, we maintain them improperly. For instance, there was a case at the Davis-Besse nuclear plant. There's a 6-inch thick steel lid for the reactor that had not been maintained in years. It just had been overlooked. When they finally got around to looking at it, they realized that it was down to a very, very thin level, about 0.5 inch or less, and it was likely to give way pretty soon. Fortunately, they found it before that happened.
My guest this hour is Lloyd Jeff Dumas, professor of political economy and public policy at the University of Texas at Dallas. His new book is called The Technology Trap, where human error and malevolence meet powerful technologies. Back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lloyd Jeff Dumas, professor of political economy and public policy at the University of Texas at Dallas. His new book is The Technology Trap, Where Human Error and Malevolence Meet Powerful Technologies. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. This seems like something out of the movies, but can you talk about the significance of the threat of war by accident?
We often believe that war won't start unless somebody takes an intentional act to begin the war, but actually that's not true. The First World War was probably the best example of an accidental war that we've had. It was launched by a German attack on Luxembourg in 1914. And actually, the Kaiser, who had ordered the attack, issued a countermanding order to stop, not to attack. So it would have prevented World War One. But the order never got – well, it did get – actually, it did get to the frontline generals, but it got there 30 minutes after the attack was launched. So his people reported that a mistake had been made and the war had been started. Of course, once the war is started, people are shooting at each other. It's not an accident anymore. Yeah, and it ran out of control of all of the diplomats in Europe, and it wound up killing somewhere between 9 and 11 million people. That was an accidental war. The fact is it could be much worse these days. Accidental war could occur with nuclear weapons. There was an example in the late 1980s. The Indian military was preparing for a military exercise near the Pakistani province of Sindh, which is on the border. And the Pakistanis somehow didn't get the message that this was an Indian military exercise. They knew that there was a secessionist sentiment being expressed in Sindh. They thought the Indians were getting ready to attack. So they built up their troops. The Indians saw the Pakistanis doing this and said, oh, they're getting ready to attack us. So they built up their troops. And before you knew it, there were a million soldiers on that border, on both sides of the border, ready to start a war with each other. It wouldn't have taken much for it to happen. But finally, the diplomats got the message through, and everybody realized this was all a mistake and backed down. Now, in 1999, the Pakistanis did attack some Indian outposts near the town of Kargil in Kashmir. And both countries by that time had nuclear weapons. It almost got out of control again, and both countries made multiple threats for using nuclear weapons against each other. Now, even if that had happened with a few weapons, tens of millions of Pakistanis and Indians would have died. It would have been horrible. That could even happen with a general nuclear war. So we have to do everything we can to prevent such a possibility. And to me, the only really effective way of eliminating the potential for nuclear weapons disaster or accidental nuclear war is to get rid of the weapons, because we'll never get rid of the fallibility of our systems or ourselves as human beings.
You write about the fact, for those of us who grew up during the Cold War, there was always the fear of the U.S. versus what was then the Soviet Union, and there was this hotline installed in the 1960s to prevent exactly the kind of scenario that you're just talking about. That has malfunctioned half a dozen times?
At least, yes, at least. That's what we know about publicly. One of the problems with investigating these issues is, fortunately, in a country like the United States, there is a lot of public information, so that makes it possible. But many things that happen are not made public. For instance, the American military has a system called the Personnel Reliability Program, which anybody who has any access to or responsibilities in controlling the release of nuclear weapons is subject to. It's basically a series of physical and mental requirements that would prevent somebody considered unreliable from getting into position in that kind of duty to start with.
You want mentally healthy people in
yes,
those spots.
Sure, mm-hmm. sure. Or remove them from duty after they become unreliable. Well, over a period of 15 years for which there were public data released from 1975 to 1990, an average of 4,100 people a year were removed permanently from nuclear duty. That means they were on nuclear duty. The original tests had not prevented them from becoming assigned to nuclear duty. We don't know how long they were unreliable before it was noticed and they were taken off nuclear duty, but that amounts to about 66,000 people over a 15-year period. But then the military stopped releasing the data. I'm sure they didn't stop having the problems. So we can say some things about what happens. We can't be sure exactly what's happened in that particular case, how many removals there have been in the last 20 years, because the data are no longer public.
And even people who are okay on a normal basis can take drugs or alcohol and have a problem temporarily, but immediately.
Sure, you can just have a bad day. I mean, we all have situations where we're not as sharp as we usually are. We're not as alert as we usually are. That's one of the things about errors involving dangerous technologies. They don't have to be continuous to be catastrophic. If the guy who's guarding the guys who are guarding the nuclear weapons storage area are not fully alert at the moment that a group of terrorist commandos tries to break in and steal nuclear weapons, a disaster beyond history could occur. But nobody's alert all the time, and you never know when that attack is going to occur. I spoke with someone who was actually a former student of mine who became a nuclear weapons guard and also a trainer of nuclear weapons guards. And the way he put it was, when you're up to your knees in snow in North Dakota in January on a 12-hour shift patrolling around the nuclear weapons area, you're not likely to be at the peak of efficiency at all moments. That's just a human reality. It's not a result of bad behavior on their part. It's just what happens to people under those circumstances. A lot of work that involves nuclear technologies and other dangerous chemicals, technologies, and so on is basically very boring work. For instance, there have been nuclear power plant operators routinely found asleep on the job. You'd say, how could you do that in a technology that's so potentially dangerous? But most of what they actually do is take an occasional meter reading and watch some lights flash on a board. It's very boring work, and you have to be very highly trained to do it. You don't get to use most of your skills most of the time. And that makes people a bit duller than we need them to be in situations like this. So the best thing we can do is to move to different kinds of technologies that allow us a much larger margin for error.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Nat in Frisco. Hi, Nat.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Good. Hey, thanks for taking my call in such a fascinating conversation. My question is, or my comment and question both, is this. I studied economics, so I am fascinated by supply and demand, and that applies to the technology in a way, because we human beings, we are often a creature and often the fruit of supply and demand. So therefore, we demand based on the demand, we create technologies. Now, with that being said, how does that go toward creating new technologies and not creating new technologies, because we are always going to be evolved, and that's how we are from the beginning of the day. So we are always going to seek new technologies. Now, I'm not a big fan of bad technologies, and I'm a fan of the technologies. So what I'm trying to figure out is that how can we define a bad and good technologies? Because anytime we develop any technology, therefore, we have to develop something else in order to support them. So we create that environment of technological development. So therefore, we evolve day by day by day, and we change the way that we live our lives.
Well, those are really interesting points, Nat. Let's see if we can get a response for you. This is something that you address in the book, The Economics of All of This.
Yes. Thanks, Nat, for calling. There is a demand for the services of the technology. That is, we want to be safe. We want to be able to travel. We want to be able to communicate with each other. There's not initially a particular demand for a specific technology among all of those that could do this. And all that I'm saying is that sometimes a technology gets developed that may get us partway to the goal, but may have a downside that we're not paying sufficient attention to. There are other ways of achieving the objective that are much safer. We should pay more attention to those ways. For instance, the maximum credible accident, let me put it in the terms that you have raised. we have a demand for electricity for all sorts of reasons. It does all sorts of interesting things, allows us to use all sorts of other technologies. So we have nuclear power plants that generate electric power. And basically, that's all they do. They generate electric power. But if things go major league wrong with a nuclear power plant, it could kill tens of thousands of people. It could do a huge amount of property damage, multiple tens of billions of dollars. Whereas the same electricity can be generated with a wind farm, and the worst accident that could possibly occur at a wind farm might kill a few people or do a few million dollars worth of damage. The difference is enormous. So I think what you're pointing to is right. We didn't get these technologies by accident. We got them because we wanted something. We wanted safety. We wanted to be able to, we wanted security for the country. We wanted to be able to travel faster, communicate better. But there are alternate ways of achieving these technologies, which may give us a much larger margin for error than the technologies we currently have. And in fact, a lot of these are online already. The electricity that powers my house is from wind power through the electric company that I deal with. It's just as the same as if it were generated by nuclear power. I can't tell the difference when I plug in the wall. The electric current is there, and that's what I care about. That's what the demand is for.
Nat used the terminology good technology and bad technology, and you use something slightly different, which is inherently dangerous. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Inherently dangerous technologies are those where something really catastrophic could happen either in the normal operation or when something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. A technology can be designed to be dangerous, like nuclear weapons and chemical and biological weapons. Obviously, they're designed to kill lots of people and do lots of damage. But technologies can also be designed for benign purposes, and the one that I just mentioned, nuclear power, is one of those examples. It's designed for a very benign purpose. It generates electricity that we need to power all sorts of devices. I wouldn't say one technology is good and one technology is bad. What I would say is the consequences of things going wrong, or even sometimes the consequences of the normal operation of these technologies, can be more or less dangerous. For instance, take wind farms and nuclear power again, just as an example. Wind farms don't generate waste that is as toxic and as dangerous and as long-lived as nuclear power plants do, but they do deliver the electricity. I'm not making an argument in favor of wind farms only. There's lots of other forms of technology that allow us that same margin for error. But I am trying to contrast. There are technologies which are not good or bad in themselves, but expose us to more danger. And if we don't need to be exposed to that danger to achieve the overriding objective we're trying to achieve, like safety or faster travel or electric current in our houses, we ought to choose the safer technologies because you can be sure that things will eventually go wrong.
Of course, I know that you've had, this is not always an easy argument to make. People will say wind power is great, but in terms of the amount of power that it can generate in a certain amount of time over a certain amount of real estate, it's going to lose to nuclear technology. Can you talk about why you think safety ought to be moved up the priority list?
Well, simply because, let me put it this way, Chris. In the beginning of nuclear power, we knew that nuclear waste generated by these plants, now that's not from an accident, that's from normal operation. We knew that it would be very dangerous, that it would be a potential source of nuclear proliferation of weapons. So we were concerned about it, but we believed, well, this is the 1950s. By the time the 1960s or 70s come around, we will have solved this problem too. Nuclear power is such a neat thing. It can produce so much energy for us and so on. So we started building nuclear power plants, figuring we'd eventually solve this problem. Well, it's 2011, and we still haven't completely solved that particular problem. We have tons and tons, thousands of tons of nuclear waste in various places around the country. We still don't know how to safely store it. So if we had been a little less optimistic and a little more realistic about what we were doing, we might have pushed other technologies instead. There were massive subsidies given to nuclear power, and for that matter, to oil and coal-based technologies, and not to other renewable technologies, to level a playing field, to give some assistance to those other technologies, or even to eliminate the subsidies of the technologies with which they would compete and create a level playing field. that renewable technologies would look a lot better to us. In fact, in terms of amount, the state of North Dakota by itself has enough developable wind technology to supply about 20% of the electricity needs of the entire United States. That's one state, and it's not the only state. 46 of the 50 states have developable wind power resources. But again, there's also solar power, there's geothermal power, there's tidal power. There are all sorts of other renewable energy sources we can use that are not generating greenhouse gases and are producing the electricity we need, but do not expose us to waste or to operational dangers on the level of nuclear power plants.
Let's go back to the phone now. This time, our caller is Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, the theme of technology in the hands of fallible human beings is discussed repeatedly during the Cold War in films like Dr. Strangelove, which takes a sort of a dark, humorous turn on the subject, and Failsafe, which is quite serious, The Missiles of October. We lived in a very black and white world. It was for sort of us and them, very black and white environment. I was hoping you could discuss how our current culture processes these themes, because it's far more complicated, far more grayer than the world that we lived in during the Cold War. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
That's an interesting point, Ken. First of all, just as a sidelight, I did a little consulting on the film that turned into War Games, so I know about these films. And they're very important because they help us to picture what could happen before it happens so we can take whatever appropriate actions to make sure it doesn't happen. I think that's a very important thing. We live in a more complex world, but we're still thinking in a Cold War mentality. For instance, you know, I was on the air. I don't remember where this was, but I was doing an interview shortly after the 9/11 attacks. I think it was the next day or within a couple of days. And it was a call-in show. One of the people called in and said, you know, the problem is we need more nuclear weapons. If we had more nuclear weapons, those terrorists wouldn't attack us. And I said, do you think they know? They don't know we have scads of nuclear weapons? They don't know we have the world's most powerful military? The threats that we face today do not require the same kind of response that the threat we faced in those days you're referring to required. So we have much more flexibility to move in different directions now. There is no reason to have these huge arsenals of nuclear weapons that we have now, or that the Russians have, or that the French or the Chinese or the British have, for that matter, the Indians or the Pakistanis, or recently the North Koreans. We have other ways to protect ourselves that are much more efficient and much more effective, and I think we ought to move toward them.
We'll resume our conversation in a moment with Lloyd Jeff Dumas. His new book is The Technology Trap, where human error and malevolence meet powerful technologies.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lloyd J. Dumas, professor of political economy and public policy at the University of Texas at Dallas. His new book is called The Technology Trap, where human error and malevolence meet powerful technologies. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. That number is where we find Anne in Richardson. Hi, Anne.
Hello. Hello, Dr. Dumas. I'm wondering if, when I think about, you've addressed a lot of technology issues and the safety related to them and how to minimize that, but I'm wondering how much the problem is due to us, you know, as a culture, being unaware of where our electricity comes from, where our water comes from, where our food comes from, and the sense that we always just have that we can flick the switch and it turns on. And I'm wondering if you've thought about how that affects the safety issues related to, well, how we use technology in our society and how we've become dependent and don't think through it.
I think, Anne, that you've hit on something very important. Actually, most of us don't seem to care where it comes from, as long as it's there. We plug into the wall. We want the current to be there. We don't do a lot of thinking. You're right. We don't do a lot of thinking about where it's coming from. And that leads us into a situations where a technology that might be a little bit cheaper but much more dangerous looks attractive to us because our electric bill will be a little bit lower. And similarly for other kinds of technologies. We don't give a lot of thought to nuclear weapons. I think most of us don't. We just want to be safe, and we're not thinking really about whether they're keeping us safe or whether they've outlived their usefulness. On that, we do need to think a bit more, and that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, and one of the reasons why I write a lot of what I write is to try to get people to think, to try to move, in the spirit of this show, to get people to think, to try to move the debate into a more reasoned discussion of what the benefits and costs of different alternatives may be. I think, and I think a lot of even famous cold warriors who've come to the conclusions that nuclear weapons have outlived their usefulness, Henry Kissinger and George Shultz, Sam Nunn, have jointly authored an article in the New York Times, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal a few years ago, calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. The former commander of the Strategic Command that controls all American nuclear weapons, Navy and Air Force, all strategic weapons, when he retired, called for the abolition of nuclear weapons. There have been a statement signed by more than 60 admirals and generals from all of the nuclear powers endorsing the idea that we don't need nuclear weapons anymore. Now, that's just one example of a dangerous technology, but it's a very dangerous technology that most of us don't think much about in our daily lives. Why should we? We have a lot of other things to think about, and I don't have any problem understanding that. But we have to give some thought to directing the country in ways that actually make us safer rather than more endangered. Getting rid of nuclear weapons is one way to do that for sure.
Well, let's talk about that, Jeff, because I think maybe we've come to a place where a lot of smart leaders in the world say, yes, the world might be better off without nuclear weapons. We just want to go last in getting rid of ours. Everybody else goes first, and then once we're certain that no one else has them, then we'll get rid of ours. I would argue the United States is in that position.
Sure, we have been for a long time, but the fact is we've had a commitment, a formal treaty commitment, since 1968. It's more than 40 years ago. To get rid of nuclear weapons. In the Non-Proliferation Treaty, there was a deal made between countries that didn't have nuclear weapons and countries that did. The countries that did, who signed the treaty, agreed to get rid of them in exchange for the countries that didn't agreeing not to develop them. So, in effect, we've had a formal treaty commitment for more than 40 years to get rid of nuclear weapons. Now, people like Henry Kissinger, Robert McNamara, former Secretary of State, former Secretary of Defense, former Secretary of Defense William Perry, are not unaware of the problems in the world and the security issues that surround the United States. But they have all signed on to, in fact, as has President Obama, signed on to the idea that nuclear weapons need to be eliminated. We have a problem how to do it. We have to do it a bit at a time, but we can get it done. And I think we can let go of them when we realize that they're not actually making us secure. They're exposing us to danger.
One of the solutions you propose here is more effective security, which, according to you, is about more diplomacy and less aggression. Do you feel like we're making steps in that direction?
Well, I hope so, but it's a little hard to see. Let me put it this way, Chris. Security comes from relationships, not from weapons. For instance, I mean, that sounds like a touchy-feely statement, but let me explain it a little bit more. During the whole of the Cold War, we spent trillions of dollars and much time and effort at the Pentagon thinking about how to deal with Soviet Union and all of its nuclear weapons and the threat that it posed to the United States. But the truth is, for a lot of that time, both Britain and France had enough nuclear weapons to do in most of the United States as well. We didn't spend 10 minutes or $10 thinking about them.
Because we didn't fear them.
Because we didn't fear them, because we had a much better relationship with them, a different kind of relationship with them. And after the Cold War ended, when the relationship started to warm between us and Russia, we stopped worrying about them anywhere near as much as we had been before. And now that it's getting worse again, we're starting to get more worried. It's very clear that relationships are where security comes from. You don't have to worry about your friends. You don't have to worry about those that you are engaged with in a positive way. So I think it's not soft-headed. It's just reality that relationships are at base where security comes from. It's one of the reasons why North and South Korea are not secure. They have such a crappy relationship, excuse me, for saying it that way, but they have such a terrible and hostile relationship with each other. Or Israelis and the Palestinians, the same kind of thing. we need to pay more attention to what we can do to create situations in which we improve the character of the relationships. And we can't expect to do this by everybody deciding they're going to love and care for each other. Because if that day ever comes, it's going to be a very long time into the future. What we have to think about is who people really are. We know we're motivated by self-interest. We care about the things that improve our own situation. So we need to structure security systems that create very strong self-interested positive incentives for countries to avoid fighting with each other. I think it's perfectly possible to do that. In fact, I have another book coming out this year in 2011 from Yale University Press called The Peacekeeping Economy, which is my contribution to this kind of debate over what we can do in terms of solid security approaches to keep us safe while not exposing us to the kinds of dangers we're currently exposed to.
Let's go back to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak with Anthony in Dallas. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Good to be on the show. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've called a couple times, but I just wanted to make a couple.
You know, Anthony, I'm so sorry that you are completely breaking up and now we've lost you, but it appears from the statement I have that Anthony wanted to talk a little bit about the government hoarding nuclear weapons. I wonder if you can address that a little bit and your concerns about that.
You know, as far back as the 1960s, early in the nuclear age, there were calculations done at the Pentagon as to how many nuclear weapons we really needed to be assured that we could deter the Soviet Union, and the calculation was about 200. We wound up building about 12,000 strategic nuclear weapons. So it makes you wonder, and we still have 6,000 or so or more, it makes you wonder, why did we go so far beyond what the Pentagon itself had decided was enough? And I think what happened was that nuclear weapons at some point got detached from reality. They became symbols to us, symbols of military power, symbols of national power and prestige. And you can have enough weapons to destroy a country, but you can't have enough symbols of power. So I think we just kept building them and hoarding them and almost cherishing our nuclear arsenals as symbols of who we were, of how great we were, of how powerful we were. But these things are very bad symbols because they're very dangerous. They're very dangerous to us. And hoarding them and building up more of them is not making us safer. It's making us less safe. The fact is, this deal we've recently made on the New START to cut our nuclear weapons arsenal substantially again is a move in the right direction, except that it also comes with an $80-plus billion pledge to renew and do more research on nuclear weapons. It's a complete waste of money in my opinion, and moving us in the wrong directions again.
What do you actually do with a dismantled nuclear weapon? Where does the radioactive material go, and how do you make sure that this thing that used to be a bomb is taken apart and stored in such a way that it can't hurt anyone?
Well, first of all, it's interesting to talk about where it gets taken apart, and that's in Texas. At the Pantex plant near Amarillo was the final assembly point for all American nuclear weapons except the original couple, and is the place where more than 10,000 American nuclear weapons have already been dismantled. So what you do basically is you run the weapon backwards through the assembly process. You have to do it very carefully. You take the components. Some of them are radioactive. They have to be treated as radioactive waste. The core of the nuclear weapon, which is very dangerous, plutonium or enriched uranium, has to be guarded. It has to be safeguarded. It can be. There are a couple of major approaches that can be used. You can turn it into nuclear power plant fuel, which is not my favorite alternative because it doesn't really burn the plant. They talk about burning the fuel in nuclear power plants. It doesn't really burn the fuel. It's still very dangerous when the waste is generated. You can also turn them into diluted form and put into glass or ceramic logs, so to speak. It's called vitrification. We have built some plants to do that. That, I think, is a safer alternative. But the fact is, there's no really safe alternative, but either of those alternatives is a whole lot safer than having them in the form of ready-to-go nuclear weapons.
Do you feel like there is political will to deal with the waste we have right now?
I don't know if there is, because President Obama recently decided, within the last couple of years, decided that we should close the Yucca Mountain repository. I wasn't a big fan of Yucca Mountain, so I can't say that I'm opposed to what he did. But I don't see a whole lot of attention, at least not in the public domain, being paid to this issue of what are we going to do? We can't keep storing nuclear waste where it's generated at power plants or at nuclear weapons manufacturing facilities. We have to do something more permanent with it. And there are a variety of alternatives that have been suggested, none of which are particularly good, but some are better than others. We need to have a serious national debate about that.
What about, I mean, how sophisticated do you think our national leaders are in their ability to assess risk and decide about the trade-offs of our technologies and make good choices on our behalf?
I think we have to get involved in the business. We have to make them smart. I mean, the fact is, although an engineer or scientist needs specialized knowledge to develop technologies, we don't need specialized knowledge to talk about the kinds of technologies we will accept and we won't accept. Mm-hmm. For instance, genetically modified organisms are coming technologies. They already exist, but they are going to be much more developed in the future. It's perfectly reasonable for the ordinary public to get involved in the debate of how far we go with this and where we release it and what kind of precautions we take and so on. There is nothing that a scientist or engineer knows that makes them any more capable of deciding what kinds of technologies we should develop than anything that you or I or any of your listeners knows.
Because that's a moral and ethical question.
It's a moral and ethical question. We know that technology is powerful in shaping society. We live in that society. We're going to have to deal with the shape of society that's created by the technologies we choose. We need to get involved in this business of choosing technological directions. We can and we should.
Of course, something like genetically modified foods, there's a great deal of power that rests with the consumer in those cases. With things like nuclear power, of course, you are able now to choose where your electricity comes from or, you know, from what source it's drawn. But it's a little bit harder, isn't it, for individuals to sort of make their voices heard?
It is. And that's why non-governmental organizations are so important. One of the things they do in a real democracy like the one we have is they concentrate public opinion on certain issues, the Sierra Club, the Union of Concerned Scientists, the variety of different organizations that represent pressure points. They do research. They present reports. They lobby the Congress. They push for the directions that we want to see happen. So what I think more of the public has to be aware that we can participate in this technological debate. You don't have to be trained in science or engineering to do it and to work through contributing to and perhaps reading some of the reports done by, but at least contributing to some of the organizations that seem to be pushing the directions that make the most sense to us.
And you see that almost as an obligation?
I do. I think it's part of what being a citizen in a free society is about. We have an obligation to participate in the public debate.
My guest this hour has been Lloyd Jeff Dumas, professor of political economy and public policy at the University of Texas at Dallas. His new book is called The Technology Trap, Where Human Error and Malevolence Meet Powerful Technologies. Jeff, it's always interesting. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.